This is the NPR News Update. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, January 24th. I'm John Wanamaker. Over the past few months, the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis has been forced to face allegations of clergy misconduct and cover-up. But the one thing church officials want to talk about less than clergy sex abuse is money. NPR News has been examining how church leaders diverted millions of dollars that could have been used for traditional church programs to deal with clergy misconduct. That spending, along with other financial decisions, led to lax accounting and even left the church a victim of embezzlement. Pending litigation could place the archdiocese and individual parishes in an even more vulnerable financial state. The report you're about to hear uses secret tapes, a jailhouse interview, and thousands of pages of never-before-seen internal documents to pull back the curtain on the finances of the archdiocese. Here's NPR's Tom Scheck.
The financial decisions made by the Archdiocese of St. Paul in Minneapolis are mostly hidden. Since it's a religious institution, the nonprofit doesn't have to file paperwork with government regulators or answer to shareholders or a board of directors. There is a finance council that gives Archbishop John Neinstedt financial advice, but he alone can make spending decisions. His decisions go well beyond the operations of the chancery. The Archdiocese has indirect control over 188 parishes, 91 Catholic schools, and two seminaries that serve 825,000 Catholics. The top-line budget summary of the Archdiocese looks healthy and is showing signs of recovery as investments and giving rebound from the Great Recession. But the church faces uncertainty. Like Minnesota's population, the average age of parishioners is rising, and church documents show the number of parishioners and donors is dropping. Church leaders have said publicly they're confident they'll meet their upcoming fundraising goals despite a backlash over how they've handled clergy sex abuse cases. But in private, they say they're in difficult financial waters.
We have headwinds. We have significant headwinds on this.
At a private meeting with priests in December, archdiocese fundraisers say they're changing the pitch they're making to donors. The meeting, which was recorded and a copy provided to NPR News, shows church leaders are worried the clergy sex abuse scandal will harm the bottom line. Greg Polis, director of development and stewardship for the archdiocese, told priests the annual Catholic Services Appeal will shift its focus from the archdiocese, which is at the center of the abuse scandal, to other more popular programs like Catholic Charities.
In picking those, we have deleted anything that has any semblance of money going to the core archdiocesan administrative functions.
Polis then encouraged priests to step up their own fundraising efforts.
Because guess what? They may be mad at the archdiocese, but almost to a person, none of them expresses any anger at you. And so, therefore, we need to leverage that.
The archdiocese has more than an image problem on its hands. NPR News has reviewed internal documents and interviewed key insiders who say the Twin Cities archdiocese lacked key financial controls, mismanaged money, and spent millions as a result of clergy misconduct since at least 2002. Those millions came from Catholics who donated to the church on faith, faith that their money will help the poor, build the church, and increase the flock. But top church leaders also spent about 3% of overall revenues over the last decade on costs resulting from clergy misconduct. They include payments to convince priests to leave active ministry, financial support for children fathered by priests, and money for legal settlements. Scott Domeyer, a former top accountant for the archdiocese who was convicted last year of stealing from the church, says the clergy misconduct budget was so concealed that even a trained eye wouldn't notice the expenditures.
There are definitely pieces of the funds that came in that were being spent on things that were really held quiet.
Both Domeyer and Jennifer Hasselberger, the top canon lawyer for the Archdiocese through April of last year, say the chancery worked to keep the transgressions of priests from becoming known. For example, Hasselberger said Archbishop John Neinstedt agreed to repay an elderly woman's estate after investigators started focusing on a parish priest in charge of her funds. Court records show roughly $30,000 was missing from Marion McCauley's account. The person who oversaw the estate was Father Corey Belden, a parish priest currently serving in Hamel. Hasselberger says church leaders decided to pay the money back to McCauley's estate to avoid further scrutiny. She called it an extraordinary act.
It's well out of the scope of what would happen on a regular basis. And there's a lot of questions about the ethics of using church funds for something like that.
Court records show the money was paid back, and Belden was dismissed as McCauley's conservator in 2009. NPR News contacted Belden earlier this week. He refused to comment. The Archdiocese released a statement saying Belden had a gambling problem and is making restitution to the Archdiocese. McCauley's niece, Laura Ron, still isn't happy. She says Catholics should know where their money is going.
The church has paid it back. That doesn't, in my eyes, that doesn't make it right.
Internal financial reports reviewed by NPR News show that between 2002 and 2011, the Archdiocese spent nearly $10.9 million on costs related to misconduct under Archbishops Flynn and Neinstedt. Church officials even set up accounting codes to distinguish types of expenses. One code is for costs associated for priests accused of sexually abusing children. A second code is for costs related to priests allegedly involved in abuse of adults or financial misconduct. Items with these codes include expenses for therapy costs for victims and priests. Money was spent for legal fees for priests, for victim settlements, and a $25,000 payment itemized as child support. The Archdiocese also paid more than $100,000 over a decade to a private investigator. Scott Domeyer, the former accountant, says church leaders made decisions on payments like this with little consideration of how it affected the budget.
I don't think that they would look at the financial aspect of it at all when they were cutting the deals.
Domeyer says a $126,000 annuity was established in 2003 for a child fathered by a priest. Hundreds of thousands of dollars were also spent by church leaders to rid themselves of problem priests.
They were just doing whatever they could to remove guys from ministry.
Take the case of Father Stanley Kozlak. Church records say Kozlak fathered a child in 2000. To get him out of ministry, former Archbishop Harry Flynn signed a retirement agreement with Kozlak in 2002. The agreement, obtained by NPR News, provided Kozlak with a $1,900 a month disability payment for life, $800 a month in rent for life, and money to replace his Social Security payments. Kozlak declined to be recorded for broadcast, but said it was general knowledge that he fathered a child. He declined to discuss his retirement agreement, but said, quote, "These are matters I dealt with in my life, and believe me, I paid a price for it." The Archdiocese did not respond to comments about Kozlak. Domeyer says Flynn, his successor, Archbishop Neinstedt, and their top deputies knew about payments to Kozlak and other priests. He said other employees were suspicious but didn't investigate.
Everybody knew not to ask questions because what was behind those requests for payments never got into our files, and that was on purpose.
In fact, Domeyer took advantage of a system that wasn't just secret, it was also sloppy. Domeyer is currently serving a 3-year prison sentence at the Faribault Correctional Facility. He pleaded guilty to stealing more than $650,000 from the Archdiocese between 2005 until 2011. Part of his theft scheme involved using Archdiocesan money to cover his personal expenses, and in some cases, he wrote priest support in the memo line to avoid scrutiny. Domeyer said he never thought he'd be prosecuted, especially after seeing how church leaders quietly handled clergy misconduct. He said he lost his moral compass after dealing with problem priests.
I was their primary financial contact if there was issues with their payments, and I would have to listen to their complaints about why they didn't get their money on X day, they deserved it, or why can't I get more money?
Experts who study financial controls say leaders should have discovered Domeyer's activity right away.
It's difficult to tell whether the Archdiocese simply lacked controls or whether the controls that were in place were not being enforced.
That's Charles Zeck, director of Villanova University's Center for Church Management and Business Ethics. Zeck published a study in 2007 saying 85% of the Catholic dioceses in the U.S. had experienced embezzlement between 2001 and 2006. Zeck said religious leaders often don't follow proper financial controls, like centralizing checks or requiring 2 signatures on checks over $1,000. But by now, he said guidelines should be established and followed, especially after his study and guidelines put forward by the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops in 1995.
It's hard for me to imagine how that can possibly happen given all the warnings we've seen in other dioceses of the same types of problems.
Church leaders learned of Dohmeyer's activities in December of 2011. They quickly hired Ernst & Young to review all of Dohmeyer's financial activity, over $5,000. But the auditors started asking about questionable payments to priests. Jennifer Hasselberger, the former top canon lawyer at the Archdiocese, says that's how she first learned of payments to priests who had sexual contact with children and adults.
Being responsible for records and things, I only uncovered those payments really as part of the audit when Ernst & Young came and asked me about them. And you'd think that that would be things that would easily be visible in their clergy files, but weren't.
Hasselberger says Archdiocesan attorney Andrew Eisenzimmer told her questions about those payments were outside the scope of the review. Hasselberger says Eisenzimmer told her to refer the auditor's inquiries to him. Eisenzimmer declined to be recorded for broadcast, but he says he didn't put any restrictions on Ernst & Young. Several charitable governance experts say they're puzzled why the auditors didn't do a full review of the Archdiocese's books after learning of Dohmeyer's theft. Jack Siegel is a Chicago-based tax attorney who teaches charity governance.
The minute someone tells me you don't need to look here, that's the first place I want to look.
Siegel has been raising concerns about church finances for nearly a decade. He says proper financial controls should be a basic step for any nonprofit, especially one with $56 million in total assets in the last fiscal year.
Why didn't you have better internal controls in place? And surprisingly, what is missing in the internal controls that led to the fraud is not anything that's rocket science.
It isn't certain what financial controls the Archdiocese put in place as a result of Dohmeyer's activity. Church leaders have refused for years to release detailed financial statements. The Archdiocese issued a statement this week saying they'll change that practice in February by releasing audited financial statements for fiscal year 2013. The statement also said Chief Financial Officer Tom Mertens, who was hired in December 2012, made recommendations to improve transparency. The Archdiocese declined interview requests for this story. The financial decisions made at the Chancery go well beyond the bottom line of the Archdiocesan budget. The actions taken by the church also affect the parishes and the Catholics who attend Mass there.
That's reporter Tom Scheck. And if you'd like to hear more about the story and see more, go to nprnews.org. Tom will also talk about the backlash that was felt in the parishes over the Archdiocese actions. State officials say they are evaluating tribal agencies' claim that inaccurate data was used in the environmental study for a proposed copper-nickel mine. Elizabeth Dunbar has more.
The data has to do with flow rates for the Partridge River, which is located near where PolyMet wants to build the mine. It's important because it helps estimate how contaminants from the mine could reach waters that eventually flow into Lake Superior. Margaret Watkins is a water quality specialist with the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. The tribes have been raising questions about the data for years.
We think that this is a data poor project and that more analysis needs to be done.
Officials at the Department of Natural Resources have acknowledged a discrepancy between data used for the study and new data the agency collected, but they say it's too early to know whether that new data will lead to major changes. A third and final public hearing on the project's environmental study is set for next week. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Documents obtained by Minnesota Public Radio News show who are the winners and losers when it comes to securing state grant money. Reporter Curtis Gilbert sat down with All Things Considered host Tom Cran to talk about what he found in the numbers.
Newly released internal state documents pull back the curtain on a highly competitive and high-profile grant program. The program helped fund the new St. Paul Saints Ballpark, a planned office tower in Duluth, and the Southwest Light Rail Transit Project. The documents show the $2 million grant to Southwest came at the expense of downtown development in Maple Plain and athletics facilities at Minneapolis Public Schools. Curtis Gilbert has been looking into this, and he joins me now in the studio with more. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Tell me about these two projects. What were they?
Well, the project in Minneapolis was new updated athletics facilities. It was an artificial turf at a high school. There was a swimming pool at a middle school. Also, Victory Memorial Ice Arena. These were all hoped to be renovated by Minneapolis Public Schools. And then in Maple Plain, this was a for a city that small, a big downtown development to make retail space and a healthcare facility. In all, 90 projects applied for these grant funds. Only 9 were funded, but Minneapolis and Maple Plain weren't on the final list.
Now, how is this grant program different from what we hear about all the time at the Capitol, the bonding bills that typically fund projects like this, right?
Well, this was supposed to make the project less political back in 2012. The idea was that state staff would score the applications based on objective criteria, and state staffers ranked Minneapolis and Maple Plain, their proposals, second and third among all metro area projects just behind the Saints ballpark. And they were, Minneapolis and Maple Plain, they were on the list of projects recommended for funding until just 2 days before the winners were announced.
So second and third among all of the metro projects recommended for funding. Why weren't they funded?
Governor Mark Dayton said at the time that he was going to make the final decisions on which of these projects to fund, and he decided to fund the Southwest Light Rail project instead, even though staff hadn't recommended it. And Dayton was open about that at the time, that Southwest wasn't on the, you know, the recommended list.
And so why did the governor go for the Southwest Light Rail instead?
Well, the Metropolitan Council, which manages the construction of the Southwest Light Rail, made the case that without at least $2 million from the grant program, hundreds of millions of federal dollars were going to be at risk, maybe even the whole project. That money had to come from somewhere, and we learned this week that it came from Minneapolis and Maple Plain.
So what reaction have you been hearing from Minneapolis Public Schools or Maple Plain at all about any of this?
Well, I did exchange emails with the former city administrator from Maple Plain who was in that job at the time, and he told me that the city felt slighted and disappointed. Nothing has happened with that land, he said, in part because the grant fell through. Minneapolis Public Schools did renovate the swimming pool on its with its own money at Olson Junior High, but the other two projects have not gone through. I talked to the lobbyist at Minneapolis Public Schools. Obviously, they wish their projects had gotten funded, but they say they understand why the governor made the decision he did, and that's one of the things that governors get to do. They get to make decisions.
So all of this happened, we should say, back a couple of years ago in 2012. How come we're just hearing about it now?
Well, there was a lot of media interest in this program back then. And so on the very day that those grants were announced, I put in a request to the state of Minnesota, give me all the internal emails and documents. And under Minnesota law, that stuff's generally considered public information.
Right.
But there's a sort of a timeline. Some things had to be finalized about these grants. And so for the next 16 months, we'd keep on checking. We kept on hearing that they weren't ready yet. And finally, I decided to go look at the law myself, and I decided that the state was really taking a very conservative view of what the law said in terms of this public data. NPR got a lawyer involved, and this week we got to sort through 2,000 pages of internal Minnesota state emails.
All right, Curtis Gilbert, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And Curtis has posted the highlights of what he found on our website at nprnews.org. This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. Some Minnesota lawmakers say they will make another push to pass more restrictive gun laws this session, but passing new or tighter laws may not deter the most persistent gun offenders based on data from gun crimes last year. NPR News examined more than 450 gun charges filed in Hennepin County District Court in 2013. And found that more than a third of suspected offenders were already legally barred from possessing guns. Brant Williams reports, and in an advisory, this story contains one instance of offensive language.
For the last 3 years, dozens of people have come to the Church of the Ascension in North Minneapolis to remember those killed by people with guns. About a dozen women sitting in the creaky wooden pews wear red jackets or blouses to indicate they've lost a child to violence. Portraits of the slain, mostly young men, sit on white marble steps which lead to the pulpit under the majestic vaulted ceiling of the 120-year-old sanctuary. Gospel singer Cortland Pickens brings members of the once somber crowd to their feet with a message crafted for the theme of the day's ceremony.
I believe he will turn your mourning into dancing and your sorrow into joy. Yes, he will.
But the organizers of the ceremony don't just want mourners to find solace. Heather Martens is executive director of Protect Minnesota, one of the sponsors of the event.
So the message today is we are honoring those we've lost and we want to make sure they did not die in vain.
Martens and other advocates say one way to help prevent more gun deaths is to pass new and stricter laws, such as requiring background checks for private gun sales. And members of her group will be back at the Capitol this year to lobby for that. But will new gun laws deter people most likely to commit gun crimes? NPR News examined 465 cases charged in adult court involving gun-related crimes allegedly committed in Hennepin County in 2013. In many cases, the alleged offender was not supposed to have a gun. Nearly 40% of these gun cases involved a charge called prohibited person in possession of a firearm. These are people who were already convicted of serious offenses.
History has shown us that these are the people who are always around some kind of violence.
Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman says tough penalties are a deterrent to some, but he says many felons know how to get around laws designed to prevent them from getting guns.
People in the street are plenty smart. You know, a lot of times they give the guns to juveniles because they won't suffer the same kind of penalty. Or if somebody's going to get a gun and wants a gun, sends their girlfriend into the gun store to buy it for the felon because the felon can't buy it.
Freeman's office prosecuted at least one case last year in which the suspect and a victim were both banned from possessing guns. Around 4 a.m. on February 3rd of last year, then 24-year-old Chase Dent Wells knocked on the bedroom window of his former girlfriend, Pearlene Amy McGee. Dent Wells had recently been blowing up McGee's phone with dozens of calls and angry text messages after McGee announced on Facebook that she had a new boyfriend. She let Dent Wells in the house, and a few minutes later, the young man lay bleeding on the floor after being shot three times by McGee's father.
Once in the back of the head, once in the back left shoulder, and in the leg.
Attorney Bobby Joe Champion represented Dent Wells in court after he was charged with assault and several other offenses.
The second thing that's interesting about this case is that the person who shot the defendant is also a prohibited person who's not supposed to have a firearm.
55-year-old Amos McGee has prior criminal convictions which make him ineligible to legally possess firearms. So does Dent Wells. Amos McGee testified that he shot Dent Wells with a .22 caliber pistol when he thought the younger man was going to shoot him first. Amos McGee testified that he bought his pistol, quote, off the street. Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman says his office decided not to charge McGee for illegal gun possession because of the circumstances surrounding the shooting. Freeman says he believes Dent Wells threatened Amos McGee and his daughter. However, the jury acquitted Dent Wells of all charges. Champion, who is also a DFL state senator, says it's possible tougher laws could have made it more difficult for Amos McGee to get a gun. And Champion says he supports requiring background checks for private gun sales. But Champion says strict gun laws can only do so much.
I don't want just stronger gun laws from the perspective of prosecuting people, right? You just want to be able to prosecute someone. I think you want to create opportunities for people to distance themselves from that sort of lifestyle, make it a little more difficult for them to get guns in their possession, and so that we all will be safe and we can continue to be productive and thriving citizens.
NPR News analysis of last year's Hennepin County gun cases found the median age of suspected gun offenders was 26. The oldest offender was 80. The youngest was 17. Only 6% of suspects were women. 41% of gun crimes charged in 2013 involved violent acts such as assault, robbery, attempted murder, or murder. We contacted more than a dozen men convicted of gun crimes last year to ask them if they thought new or stronger gun laws would have deterred them from carrying guns. All of them declined our request. However, some former gang members say when they were in gangs, they weren't afraid of getting arrested for carrying guns.
I didn't have no fear whatsoever. I didn't even care.
19-year-old Demetrius Harris says he grew up in the Cabrini Green housing projects in Chicago and joined a gang when he was 13. He didn't come from a broken home. Harris says he had a supportive family and stable home environment. He says he chose to hang out in the streets because he got a charge out of carrying a gun around. Harris says even getting shot when he was 18 didn't discourage him from the gang life.
It's just like amped me up, like, niggas want to shoot. I got something for him. Like.
Eventually, Harris got tired of the lifestyle and left Chicago. He joined the North 4 program based in North Minneapolis. The program helps young African-American men like Harris get educated and employed. One of Harris's fellow program members, 20-year-old Delvin Jones, has a similar story. Jones says when he was carrying guns, he didn't even think about getting caught. He says guns and violence were just another part of life in the North Minneapolis neighborhoods he grew up in.
I asked him if he would have turned out differently had he grown up in a more peaceful neighborhood.
Yeah, I would have been a square. For real. I would have never, oh man, I wouldn't be in a program right now. I would have never came to the program. I would have been set. But that ain't how it worked out for me.
When the new legislative session starts next month, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman says he'll push again for tougher penalties for gun offenders. However, lawmakers who want to pass new gun laws or any controversial legislation this year will likely have a fight on their hands. All House seats are up for re-election this fall, and some legislators may want to avoid voting on a hot-button issue that could alienate some voters. Brant Williams, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
The Minnesota Orchestra announces its classical concert season today. Musicians will be playing their first concerts in a newly renovated orchestra hall following a 15-month lockout. The season includes 41 concerts and some big names, including Osmo Ventska, who stepped down as the orchestra music director during the lockout. Ewan Kerr reports.
After the bitterness of the orchestra's labor dispute, this season is meant as a crowd pleaser. Minnesota Orchestra General Manager Bob New is enthusiastic.
I think the notion was we wanted to find some of the greatest and most popular pieces of our repertoire.
There have been no concerts in Orchestra Hall by the Minnesota Orchestra since June 2012, when it closed for renovation. The locked-out musicians played dozens of concerts elsewhere. New doesn't hesitate when asked which concerts excite him the most.
Well, the opening concert, of course. I mean, to finally hear the orchestra in this hall, this renovated hall, is just going to be so terribly exciting.
There had been a skeleton of a season in place all along. But when the settlement with the musicians came, New and his staff, in consultation with the musicians, made it a real season. The orchestra season folds in three concerts the musicians had planned independently during the lockout, including an appearance by violinist Joshua Bell.
All credit goes to the musicians on that, and that was a fairly easy transference because the date worked very nicely in our schedule, and Josh is a good friend of our musicians but also of the association, so that whole thing just on a relationship basis just ended up moving very naturally to us.
Something else that will appear natural to many fans will be former music director Osmo Ventska back on the podium. He'll conduct the Bell concert and five others, including Grammy celebration concerts of Sibelius in late March and two concerts to mark the reopening of Northrop Auditorium in early May. Many audience members want Ventska to return. When asked what it means that Ventska is on the schedule so often, News' answer is brief.
It means that we love having Osmo on the stage.
I think everybody's trying to read something into that.
Principal cellist Tony Ross says he doesn't have any inside information on the Ventska situation, but he is hopeful.
We know that Osmo is extremely important to our organization on every level. He is a brilliant leader, a brilliant conductor, and we look forward to working with him some more.
Ross points out the musicians don't get to hire the music director. Orchestra managers say the board won't take up the question until after it's elected new leadership, which won't happen until at least the end of next week. Ross was a member of the musicians' negotiating team. He also collaborated with management on the season and says it shows a commitment to the classical repertoire which the musicians wanted. Despite the settlement, the musicians are still weeks away from getting their first paycheck, as the lockout doesn't end until February 1st. Ross is looking forward to the new season, but stepping back into Orchestra Hall for the first rehearsal?
It will be an experience none of us will know. I'm sure it will be intense, but we don't know exactly how, in what way, you know.
Subscriptions for the new season go on sale Monday, and single tickets on February 9th. Details of the renamed Pop Season, now to be called Live at Orchestra Hall, and Sommerfest will be released next week. Ewan Kerr, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A judge has set a trial date for a central Minnesota man accused of shooting and killing two teenagers who broke into his home. Matt Sepik reports.
65-year-old Byron Smith has pleaded not guilty to charges of first-degree murder in the deaths of 17-year-old Nicholas Brady and 18-year-old Haley Kiefer. Authorities say on Thanksgiving Day in 2012, Smith shot and wounded, then later killed the teens after they entered his home. Prosecutors initially charged Smith with second-degree murder, but later they went to a grand jury, which returned a first-degree murder indictment for the deaths. Last week, the Minnesota Court of Appeals declined to review Morrison County Judge Douglas Anderson's decision not to dismiss the charges. Now Anderson has scheduled Smith's trial to begin April 14th in Little Falls. Washington County Attorney Pete Orpit is prosecuting the case. Orpit says the judge has set aside a week for jury selection, with arguments in the case to start April 21st. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And reporter Laura Ewan has more on a benefit concert that will be held tonight for victims of a New Year's Day fire in Minneapolis.
The concert at the Cedar Cultural Center is the latest effort to help 28 people who were injured or displaced by the fire 3 weeks ago. Two relief funds for the victims and their families have so far collected $25,000, but that's short of what organizers hope to raise. They say a large share of the contributions went to help pay for the burials of three men who died from the blast. The survivors continue to look for permanent housing. The director of the nearby Brian Coyle Community Center says most of the displaced are temporarily crashing with friends or family. The concert at the Cedar will feature West Bank music legends as well as young Somali-American singers. Show sponsors want to raise $10,000, all of which would go toward victims and their families. Laura Ewan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, January 24th. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.